This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, a writer and analyst for MLB.com. Out there on the internet with me is Matt Myers, MLB.com's national content editor, and we have a lot to get to today. A little later on, we're going to have as a guest our friend Will Leach on the Baltimore Orioles and some surprising players. But first, we've got a couple of bits of breaking news we're going to get to in a segment we call The Opener. We're going to have our purpose pitches at the end of the show where Matt and I can rant and rave, and we're also going to make sure to introduce you to a couple of interesting players you may or may not have heard of. The biggest news in baseball of the last 24 hours or so, I guess, is that Mike Soroka, pitcher for the Atlanta Braves, is out for the year with a ruptured Achilles tendon suffered last night against the Mets. I was watching that as it happened, and you could tell right away if you could read his lips, and there were several F-bombs dropped pretty much the moment his foot hit the ground. And it's really, I mean, obviously it's terrible for the Braves, as Freddie Freeman was quoted saying, to sum it up, this night just sucks, because they also lost 7-2 to the Mets. But Mike Soroka last year was such a revelation for them. You know, sixth in the Cy Young, second in Rookie of the Year, 175 innings of 2.68 ERA, and now he's out for the year. So that's bad, obviously, for him, but it's very bad for the Braves, who now have, I guess, 4/5 of their projected original rotation unavailable for various reasons. Soroka is hurt. Mike Foltynewicz was DFA'd. Cole Hamels is out with shoulder inflammation. Felix Hernandez chose not to participate in the season. So, Matt, it's Max Fried and question marks, I suppose.
It's not great for the Braves, who, I mean, are 7-3 and have been playing well, and are, and considering that, you know, the Phillies and Marlins each had to, like, lost a week of their season due to COVID-related things. It's the Braves are well positioned, but it's not a good look right now for the rotation. And as you mentioned, like, pitching depth, I think it's like, if we a year ago when we talked about the Braves, it was like one of the reasons I felt like they were so successful last year was that they had, like, on their 40-man roster, like, 8 reasonable starters. It was like, oh, like, okay, well, you know, so-and-so's not available. Okay, we're just going to bring in Sean Newcomb. And it was like they were well positioned to kind of deal with this sort of thing. And suddenly that is no longer the case. I don't really know what they're going to do. I guess to hope for the best with what they have and figure that their lineup, which actually hasn't been very good, maybe they hope that their lineup can kind of pick things up and balance out some of the shortcomings in the rotation.
Yeah, I agree with you on all that. The thing I think that helps them is that the rest of the National League East is kind of a disaster in a lot of ways. You know, the Mets have looked terrible, right? Like, 3/4 of their infield got hurt yesterday, and Yoenis Cespedes is choosing not to play, and the bullpen is sort of imploding again. I mean, this is all very Mets. If you've watched a Mets game, you know, ever, this is sort of what happens. They're 4-7 last place. Obviously, no one's too far out at this early point in the season. And then, you know, the Phillies and the Marlins have barely played. Like, they're going to get back to action. The Phillies did last night, actually. But, you know, the Phillies bullpen, I thought, was a huge question mark before the season. We don't know enough about them now to say if that's different. And the Nationals have been okay, I guess. So, like, I look at the Braves and I'm hugely, concerned about the rotation, but I think they've gotten themselves off to such a good enough start at 7-4 that it's hard for me to say they're not going to be one of the 8 teams in the playoffs. And you mentioned the offense, and you're right. Marcelo Zunis had such a weird start. He's crushed the ball, right? Like, on offense, he's been really good. He's sort of living up to everyone who looked at the underlying stats last year and said, well, he underperformed. And then he still looks like a disaster in the outfield. I don't know how long they can actually play him in the field. But yeah, if you look at the Braves rotation now, I guess it's what, number one starter Max Fried, who I like very much, by the way, Sean Newcomb, Kyle Wright, some kind of combination of Tuki Toussaint, Bryce Wilson, Ian Anderson. Hamels comes back in September, maybe. They still have Foltynewicz in the organization because no one chose to claim him, although I guess that's sort of damning in and of itself. So anyway, I guess I'm happy I'm not a team in the NL East because everyone's got big problems there.
Yeah, going into the season, it was like the NL East. Everyone was like, oh, this is such a, going to be such a tough division. Like, you know, it, and obviously there's some things that, you know, kind of the COVID stuff is out of I guess we'd categorize that as out of the ordinary. And as we said in the last show, you know, it definitely hangs over the entire season and we're not naive to that fact as we discuss what's going on the field. As you said, the Mets have just not looked good. The Phillies haven't played, not because of COVID on their own team, but because of their schedule. But even still, they kind of have issues with their pitching, and the Nationals lineup with after Juan Soto looks pretty unimpressive and he's barely played. So suddenly the NL East doesn't look so great after all.
Yeah, I guess what that does is you got the 8 playoff teams, right? And it's going to be the 3 division winners and the 3 second place teams. And then the final 2 teams are just the best records beyond that. It sort of makes me look at some of the surprise teams in the NL West who have gotten off to a good start. Like the Dodgers look great, right? But the Rockies are 7-2. I don't really believe in the Rockies, but you know, first 10 games of a 60 game season, if you're off to a 7-2 start, that's really good. And the Padres, who I do believe in, are 7-4. It makes it a lot easier for me to believe that both of those teams get like reasonably high playoff spots if I don't trust anybody from the NL East, right? Like you could see the second place team in the West obviously is getting in. So that's either the Padres or the Rockies. And then you could see whichever team is third getting that number 7 spot, right? Whereas suddenly I don't feel that confident about anybody to get a third spot from the NL East. Like we know the first team and the second team will, because it's not just like a straight 1-3 ranking. It's the, you know, first place and second place, obviously. But this really just sort of benefits some of these other teams because, you know, you look at the Central and the Pirates obviously are, you know, 2-8. The Cardinals now have their own COVID issues. Yadi Molina and Paul DeJong have unfortunately tested positive, and so they're not going to play as much as a team this week. I don't know. I kind of expected the NL to be a mess, and it is, just not in this particular way, I guess is the way I would put it.
Point about the Rockies, like they're 7-2. They've got a plus 20 run differential. They're like, their pitching, which was like their strength that kind of 2 years ago when they made the playoffs, like their pitching looks legitimately like good again. And like, if I had to guess right now, it seems like they're as good a bet to make the playoffs as like, or better bet to make the playoffs right now than like the Mets or Phillies, which seems kind of crazy to think about. On a more positive note, I think we should flip to maybe one of the most impressive hitting performances of the year thus far. And you wrote about him yesterday, Aaron Judge. I mean, this is the guy that we thought we were getting every year when he after 2017, when he was rookie of the year and almost MVP. It was like, okay, here's the new superstar. Had trouble staying on the field. And now we're kind of seeing the same. We're seeing the 2017 version again, I think, for the first time really since then.
In 9 games, 40 plate appearances, Aaron Judge has 6 homers. He had a streak of 5 consecutive games with a homer that was broken last night. Hitting .314, .385, and slugging .886. Those numbers are nuts, and it really goes beyond the numbers to me. If you were watching him over the weekend against the Red Sox, now part of this is the Red Sox pitching staff is really bad, but Aaron Judge is an elite hitter, right? When he looks the way he's been looking, he's sort of, you know, must-watch TV when he comes up. And so I think, you know, the simplest answer here is probably that it's a hot streak from a really good hitter, because we're talking about a handful of games, you know. But even so, we don't have a long season, so I felt like I needed to at least dig in and check out what was going on here. And the first thing I found that I thought was kind of fun is he's actually swinging and missing a little more, and his hard hit rate is a little down. Now, that's sort of, you know, splitting hairs here, because his hard hit rate is always very good and it's still good. But what I think is really going to stand out to most people is that he's pulling the ball. If you were following Aaron Judge last year, it was sort of a thing that for like the first 4 months of the season, and he was hurt for half of that time, he did not pull the ball. I don't think he had a pulled home run until August 23rd. And now he's got 5 pulled home runs this year. Now, Matt, you dug up a very interesting video clip from MLB Network the other day where Mark DeRosa was on. And I thought what he said was interesting because, you know, Aaron Judge crushes the ball to right field, to center field. I don't think he needs a shorter trip to the outfield. But if pulling the ball is an indicator that he's healthy, which is what DeRosa was trying to get to, that might be a really, really good sign, unless you're pitching baseballs to Aaron Judge.
Yeah, what DeRosa said in this specific, very specific to Judge in Yankee Stadium, he said, you know, when you're hurting and your oblique is damaged or your wrist is damaged and you see that short porch and right, you know, Judge doesn't want to create that torque and everything that goes along with pulling the ball. So he was just kind of shooting the ball the other way. And like Aaron Judge is strong enough that he could basically like flick his wrist to home runs to right field. But now we're seeing like the Aaron Judge of 2017 hitting these mammoth blasts to left and left center field. And it has been a lot of fun to watch to see that player back. You know, last week we talked about Giancarlo Stanton back for the Yankees and mashing again, and Aaron Judge appears to be mashing again, and the Yankees look like an absolute juggernaut right now.
They absolutely do. The one thing I'll point out with the Yankees, though, is James Paxton has looked lousy, and Tommy Kahnle is out for the season, presumably with Tommy John surgery. So some weakness there. I did find it interesting, by the way, with Judge, that nobody's attacking him anymore. You know, for the last 4 years, he'd get about 30% first pitch fastballs. Now that's down to 19%. Because I get it. Why would you want to attack Aaron Judge? I'm terrified to watch him on television, much less standing 60 feet, 6 inches away from him. The other topic in our opener here we want to get to is the Cubs. And, well, let's say the Cubs starters. I won't go so far as to say the Cubs pitching staff for reasons we'll get to in a second. The Cubs are 8-2, and we all expected the NL Central to be kind of this wild ride, and I still think it will be. But the you know, Cardinals are obviously out for a while. The Reds are, you know, 5-5. The Cubs are 8-2, and a lot of that is because of their starting rotation. I think Kyle Hendricks on, what was that, opening day? Second day of the season, maybe? Yeah, that first start he had was one of the more dominating starts I think I've seen in a while, and he's so much fun to watch pitch because he's not the kind of guy who throws, you know, 98 or, you know, blows you away with raw stuff. But here's the thing about the Cubs. The Cubs starting rotation right now has a 1.95 ERA. Obviously spectacular. That is the best in baseball. The Cubs bullpen right now has a 7.55 ERA, which is awful. The worst in baseball. A lot of that is Craig Kimbrell, who has not looked very good, but it's not just him. I know like the easiest thing to say here is it'll average out and both of those things will be in the middle, but how far do you see the bullpen improving and let's say the rotation dropping from, you know, these extremes right now?
Well, you know, like everything, you know, kind of regresses to the mean, right? And that sort of seems likely. But I'm not necessarily surprised about Kyle Hendricks or Yu Darvish being this good in the rotation. The one player I am surprised to see pitching this well out of the rotation is Tyler Chatwood. Now, longtime listeners of this podcast back in the way back days when it was still the StatCast podcast will remember our affinity for Tyler Chatwood. And I think Mike wrote about him as a couple times as a potential breakout candidate.
Nope. I didn't. Never did. Definitely didn't do that.
Not trying to call you out. Well, maybe a little bit.
I think I called him the next Charlie Morton, which definitely is a take that has aged well.
Anyway, when he was a free agent in 2017, Mike was like, this is a guy, get him out of Coors Field. His curveball will, I think the curveball was kind of his go-to pitch at the time. It was like, his curveball will play better out of Coors Field. This guy could be a really good free agent pickup for someone. Of course, the Cubs, presumably working off similar data as Mike, felt the same and gave him a 3-year deal. And the first couple years of that deal did not go particularly well. In 2018, his first year with the Cubs, he had a walk rate of almost 20%. Yes, he was literally walking basically one out of every five batters, which, you know, is not good. But thus far this year, he's been fantastic. He's striking out 40% of hitters and only walking 8.5% of hitters. So it's like really gotten that strikeout walk ratio into a much better place. And he's not really relying on the curve anymore as much. He's become very reliant on a sinker and a cutter. And it looks like if you look at his, especially the right-handers, he's kind of just trying to play the two off each other where his sinker kind of breaks in a little bit to righties and the cutter breaks away. And he's using those two pitches extremely effectively. And he's been, I guess he and John Lester have both been pitching way better than anyone expected and kind of backing up behind Hendricks and Darvish, who I think, you know, most of us expected to be good to give the team for now what appears to be a really formidable starting rotation.
In on Hendricks, in on Darvish, and in on Chatwood, out on John Lester, because I know, you know, in two starts, he's got a 0.82 ERA, which is very good. He's faced 42 hitters and he has struck out 5 of them. And I don't know how that is going to be sustainable for him going forward. But yeah, the Cubs are kind of a fascinating team. The lineup has been okay. Like I think Schwarber has been hitting the ball pretty well and Bryant is back from the issues he had. So the Cubs look like they're going to be a breakout team, I guess, from the Central. But again, everything we're talking about is in the context of like 10 games for some teams. Obviously the Marlins have only played 3 games so far. Before we get to the 3 batter minimum, 2 quick things I want to get to. First, I really hope you saw the throw that Mookie Betts made from the right field corner in Arizona the other night. It was one of the more impressive throws of the year, 305 feet on a fly. And I really wanted to give just a little bit of a shout out to our colleague, Jason Bernard, who is a StatCast data analyst, because he noticed something really, really interesting. A year ago in Tampa Bay, the Red Sox were playing the Rays and Mookie Betts made this incredible throw from right field to nail a runner at third. And Jason pointed out that both throws were 305 feet in the air and both runners were running at 28.3 feet per second. That's the sprint speed where 27 is average and 30 is elite. They were two identical throws from a data perspective. And so he made a side-by-side video, which I thought was really cool. So good for Jason. The other thing I wanted to point out is that just announced on Sunday, August 16th, we're going to have an alternative broadcast of the Yankees-Red Sox game. Myself, Jason Benetti, Eduardo Perez, the StatCast broadcast on ESPN2 is our first regular season game. And I am super duper excited about it because you know what team is fun to talk about in terms of StatCast? The Yankees. Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge, Gio Urshela. We'll get to him too. So I think that's going to be pretty fun. Time to move on to our three batter minimum, where we hit three interesting topics, big picture things that are going on in baseball today. The first is something that I know, Matt, is we've talked about this for a while now. Should Shohei Ohtani just be a hitter? Ohtani this year as a pitcher, 2 starts, 1 2/3 innings, 8 walks, 3 strikeouts, 7 earned runs. In his last start out, he threw 42 pitches in the second inning. He topped out at 97 miles an hour, but the final three were 89. Not a good sign. And so the Angels announced that he is a grade 1-2 strain of the flexor pronator mass. And GM Billy Epler says, generally, you can't start throwing for this from 4 to 6 weeks. That seems to me like he's out for the season. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And I think it is, it pains me to say it because like Ohtani, the two-way player, is a really exciting, awesome thing. And for about, you know, whatever, I think in 2018 for 10 starts, it was so much fun to watch when, you know, he was like the Sunday starter and had a few like truly, truly dominant outings for the Angels on the mound. But like, The thing with Ohtani is that like this is even him not pitching like predates coming to the Angels. His final year in Japan for the Nippon Ham Fighters, he threw 26 innings. So that was 2017. He threw 26 innings. 2018, he threw 51 2/3 innings. Missed all of 2019 from pitching. In 2020, he's thrown 1 2/3 innings and is, you know, almost certainly not going to pitch again this season. And the indicators on his velocity and stuff are just, and command are just, they're all pointing in the wrong direction. On the flip side, you have Ohtani the hitter who can rake. And presumably, given his athleticism, if you said, hey, you know what, don't worry about pitching anymore, could also probably, I'm guessing, if we wanted to, and this is speculation, like become a pretty good outfielder, which they've been hesitant to do because he already has enough on his plate.
That was going to be my question. Let's say he doesn't pitch. Like he's only 26, right? You don't want to make him a full-time DH forever because one of the most underrated aspects about him is that he's really fast, you know? And I know it's been a long time since he played the outfield, but also imagine a future in Anaheim where the Angels outfield consists of Joe Adell, who just got called up and is going to make his debut, Mike Trout, the best player alive, and Shohei Ohtani. Is that a fun outfield for you? Because I want that.
The Mets basically like threw Dom Smith in the outfield with like, you know, 2 days of practice. Like if Dom Smith can go to the outfield and like not embarrass himself, I'm sure Ohtani, if like given like a full spring to train with his speed, like elite, he has like elite sprint speed, right? He's like it's small samples, but it's like, has he hit 30 feet per second, which is like the StatCast standard? I kind of feel like this is where it's going. I'm sure obviously when the Angels kind of recruited him, and at the time, you know, when the Angels signed him, there was like a ceiling on what he could get paid. So it was almost like a college recruiting where all these teams were like, had to basically make pitches to him of like, you know, you're getting basically the same offer everywhere. Here's why you should come play for us. And I'm sure like a big part of that was like, we think we can make you the most effective two-way player. So there's probably, you know, a bit of a good faith effort there that they want to like see that through. But this is now like essentially his third year. And of course, like the circumstances of this season are less than ideal and certainly made it harder for certain players to ramp up because of the calendar was so different. But just considering how good he is as a hitter and how just unreliable he's been as a pitcher and that it's cost him the chance to be in the lineup more often, I think at this point, as it pains me to say it, though, I think his future should be as a position player exclusively.
Yeah, don't forget he's a very good hitter. I think people sort of overlook that. Over the portions of the last three seasons, if you look at everybody who's taken at least 750 plate appearances, his line, so he's been about 33% above league average, it ties him for 21st, right behind Jose Altuve and Austin Meadows, like guys who are all-star caliber hitters. I also wonder if maybe it's not just strictly as a position player, maybe you can still get in some high leverage relief appearances, right? Certainly the Angels could use all the help they can get in the bullpen. Probably not this year, right? But long-term, maybe you can still get him out there for, I don't know, four or so innings a week in big spots. Maybe that shouldn't be off the table.
If he has trouble handling the, like, I have a week to prepare for my start mentally and physically, and that's been a problem for him, being able to be like, oh, you're gonna, like, the variance of relieving seems like that would just be even more dangerous and uncertain. And one more thing on his hitting, I'll admit that, like, when he came over and this was based purely on, like, his relatively high strikeout rate in Japan, I was like, this is silly. They're going to try and hit. They should just make him a pitcher. Like, there's no way he's going to hit in the majors. And it seems like his career is going in the exact opposite direction. So the lesson is always is listen, never listen to me.
can confirm. I will write that one down. All right. Topic number two. Have you noticed how much shifting is up? I think maybe you just sort of intuitively noticed that it's almost a normal part of the game now. But I looked up the early numbers and shifting is way up. Now, we define a shift as any pitch where there are three batters on one side of
three fielders, the infield.
What's that? Three fielders. I meant three fielders, not three batters. That would be a very weird shift. So we have this going back to 2015. In 2015, it happened 10% of the time. Not much change over the next couple of years. 14%, 12%, 18%. Last year, it jumped up to 26%. This year, it's up to 35%. And what I should have done, that's on all pitches. Obviously, there are some situations, runner on base, lead innings where you might not want to shift. So I probably should have, distilled it down to that. But just overall, more than a third of the time, there's a shift. And the Tigers are up to 70%. The previous team season high was last year, the Dodgers, 53%. I do not believe the Tigers will actually shift at a 70% rate all year long. It also sort of depends on who they're playing against. But the Tigers, that is not a team I would have thought of as being at the forefront of the analytical revolution. And I think they know that. Ron Gardenhire, their manager, said to Jason Beck, our Tigers beat reporter, and I quote, "We've talked about how analytically we're growing as an organization, and that's probably it. We're getting better at the craft." So if you're going to shift that often, you're probably going to save some hits, and you're probably also going to give up a lot of hits because, you're never going to save every single hit. The Tigers have allowed 49 hits against the shift, and that is the most by 13. And I think Tiger fans are sort of maybe losing their minds with it because that's a lot of balls that go through where otherwise there might still be players. So obviously that's a lot of hits allowed, but I went and looked up the quality of that contact. The Tigers have allowed a batting average on balls in play of 310 against the shift. That's third highest. So I get why fans are frustrated, but the expected batting average on balls in play, so the quality of the contact given up, is actually 383, which is second highest. So is it the shift? Maybe. Is it that the pitchers are getting lit up? Definitely. As always, the shift is a very difficult thing to quantify. I know it looks bad when it goes wrong, but there's so much that goes into it. Did you ever think you'd see a day where we'd see more than one third shifts?
No, and I'll be honest, I didn't even really notice it. The fact that shifts are, like you said, like, oh, did you even notice? Like, shifts are such a part of the game now that, like, no, I didn't even notice the increase. Did you see the other day when Jeff McNeil was shifted for the Mets from third base and he fielded the ground ball and just ran to first base? It was a five unassisted.
I did not see that, no.
I think that was probably the first time that has ever happened. Another first of something that we're seeing this year for the first time is our third topic in three batter minimum is seven inning doubleheaders, which have been brought in to kind of see if we can get in as many games as possible in this condensed season with a bunch of postponements. So what are your takes on on the seven inning doubleheaders?
I'm numb to changes at this point. There have been so many changes and a lot of them I agree with. And, it's just whatever it takes to get a season played. It makes sense. It's happened in the minors for a number of years. I understand why people don't like it. I don't have a particularly strong feeling either way. What is interesting to see is what will happen to change the strategy a little bit. So the first one happened last Sunday. The Reds swept the Tigers. And I think in the very first game, you sort of saw what the strategy could be here. So for the Reds, Anthony DeSclafani went five innings, and then he went right to Lucas Sims and Raisel Iglesias to finish. So It's a seven inning game. Like, what do you hear all the time when you have a team with a very good bullpen? You say, we're going to try to make it a seven inning game, right? Because we're going to get to our shutdown guys at the end and the other team will have no chance. Well, it's already a seven inning game. So now we're going to try to make it a five inning game, I think, right? Like, if you're a back of the bullpen reliever, you probably hate this because you're going to get skipped over a little more, or I don't know, maybe not. You're still playing two games in a day. But yeah, and then in the second game, Trevor Bauer just threw a complete game, you know, air quotes here, because seven innings, shutout. So I don't have any particularly strong feelings about whether I want this long term. For this year, it makes a ton of sense because obviously with the Marlins and the Phillies and now the Cardinals, we are going to have a lot of doubleheaders. And it's hard to think that you can force these teams to play 18 innings a day multiple times a week, which is what I think would have had to happen.
And one thing I will mention on that point you say about Trevor Bauer and his complete game, one thing, an important distinction for seven inning games is no hitters. It is not, don't be fooled. If someone throws a no hitter, it is not going to be counted as an official no hitter. So this is straight from the Elias Sports Bureau. I will read to you. No hitters by teams and individuals shall not be credited in scheduled seven inning games unless the game goes to extra inning and the team or individual pitches at least nine innings and does not allow a hit. In 1991, Major League Baseball's Special Committee for Statistical Accuracy, chaired by then-Commissioner Fay Vinson, ruled that in order for a pitcher to be credited with a no-hitter, a pitcher or pitchers had to pitch a complete game of nine innings or more without allowing a hit. Any game of fewer than nine innings in which a pitcher or pitchers do not allow a hit should be considered a notable achievement. They are noted as such in the Elias Book of Baseball Records, but it is not a no-hitter. So you heard it here, maybe not first, but if you haven't heard before, then yes, you've heard it here first. Someone throws a no-hitter and seven-inning double-hitter, it's not going to be go down in history as a as an official no-hitter.
Thank you for the history lesson. Two other weird things about this. I'm really waiting for the first time, I don't think this has happened yet, that one of these double-header games goes extra innings. Because what will happen then is you'll start the eighth, and people who aren't like following this closely will realize that there's now a runner on second for no reason to start the eighth inning. And they're going to be extremely confused, which I'm sort of excited about that. Also, there are two scheduled doubleheaders on Wednesday, Yankees and Phillies and the Marlins and Orioles. And what I find entertaining is that for both of those doubleheaders, the home teams will switch. First, it's Phillies at Yankees and then Yankees at Phillies, game played in Philadelphia, and then Marlins at Orioles and Orioles at Marlins, game played in Baltimore. What I'm fascinated to see is, will the equipment managers have multiple sets of uniforms? Will the Yankees wear pinstripes in Philadelphia and then the road grays? I hope so. If we're going to make it a home team, I hope so, but I understand if that doesn't happen.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Clearly these are my priorities here, so we're gonna have to figure that part out. All right, we're gonna take a very quick break and we are gonna come back with our guest, MLB.com's Will Leach. And we're back. Matt and I welcome in our friend Will Leach, who writes at MLB.com and pretty much everywhere else as well. Hello, Will. How are you?
It is an honor. I'm honored to be finally on the new rebranded podcast. As a fan of the old one and a fan of the new one, I'm glad I've made the crossover. I feel like we've gone from Valerie to the Hogan family.
That is a topical reference.
It's very exciting.
I'm glad that you've come to the new podcast to talk about, and I swear this is true, the Baltimore Orioles.
I don't know why not all the podcasts have been about the Orioles up to this point. I'm glad to finally bring some balance to the force.
All right. Well, tell us about the Orioles. Why are you interested in the Orioles? You wrote a whole piece at MLB.com about the Orioles.
Yes. And to be fair, as may have been mentioned somewhere on the internet, I am a Cardinals fan and there have been no Cardinals games. So I need something to direct my focus. And the Orioles are a pretty fun one. I got really excited about the Orioles. Actually, their game Saturday night. Their game Saturday night was a wild game against the Rays. People were really into it because it was the first socially distanced celebration that they were all doing after the game. Though someone pointed out that what it really looked like was like at the end of like an 80s, a 90s 8-bit video game, when all the players just jump up and down is actually what the celebration looked like. But it was a terrific game. And obviously there's no fans in the stands, but I was watching it. One of my best friends here in Athens is a diehard Orioles fan. So I'm usually just making fun of him. But I always kind of keep an eye on the Orioles because I am always kind of fascinated. I remember this with the Cubs and with the Astros, when teams are kind of bottoming out, how fans react to that. And how they will find little things to be happy about and little kind of pet players to get excited about and little victories that you're like, is this the start of the new era? Is this a point in a right direction? Looking for kind of whatever you can. And I imagine if there were fans in the stands at Camden Yards on Saturday night, they would have lost their mind. It was just like a terrific, terrific game. It went into 11 innings. It was the first time I have seen, I think this has happened one other time, where the team that eventually got the walk-off held the other team scoreless for the first two innings and then were also scoreless themselves. Like, it was actually, there was no runs despite the runner on second base three different times until Pat Valaika, of course, as the fates foretold, had the walk-off hit. So it was just a really, really exciting game. And then they won the next day and they swept the Rays. And I thought, when you add that to, so they're 5-3, we have a 60 game season. Probably. And so because of that, all of a sudden the window of just have like one or two good weeks and you can hang around for a while actually shrinks enough to where the Orioles of all teams, I'm not ready to put them in the playoffs just yet, to say the least. However, you go 5-3, you sweep the Rays, you get a Marlins team that has barely any players on it coming this week. There's all you got to do is just kind of hang in for two or three weeks with the playoff system you've got going on in the short season. They've got a chance. And to me, that would just be such an incredible way thing to happen. So I got kind of obsessed with the idea and kind of went down the Orioles rabbit hole a little bit.
It is... I have to say, and as someone who's in our last couple of shows has really talked up the Rays, I would have never expected the Orioles to sweep the Rays in the year of our Lord 2020 in a baseball series. That was definitely perhaps the biggest surprise of the season thus far was the Orioles sweeping the Rays. And they're not really trying to win this year. It's obviously still a lot of just like kind of in between players as they wait for like the cavalry of like, high draft picks to arrive in the next couple of years. But Hanser Alberto, like, is this kind of, fascinating player is the right word, but like he hit 305 last year. He doesn't strike out. He's kind of doing the same thing again, where like the batted ball indicators are like, oh, this guy isn't very good, but somehow he seems to kind of just hit for average and be kind of a useful hitter. It's a thing that's happening, I guess.
Yeah, you sound sold. I'll take you as a convert. You are sold. I can tell.
It would be a great story if they can hang it. That is that much is certain.
Well, are you actually buying into the idea that with the expanded playoffs and as you wrote, like, the rest of the East, aside from the Yankees, is kind of a mess. Like the Blue Jays don't have a home. The Red Sox do not have a single major league caliber pitcher. Like, are you buying into the fact that the Orioles could actually like? Is there a version of this bizarre, stupid year where the Orioles could actually make an expanded playoffs?
I mean, for what it's worth, don't look at me. Ask Baseball References playoff odds, which I think actually has them like up to like almost 20%, which strikes me as a tad high. even as someone that's advocating this, but Fangraphs has them at 9%. And again, these things are still unlikely. I am not predicting it will happen, but this is an insane year. And I'm just saying, if you were to put together the perfect, as I wrote in the piece, the perfect set of circumstances that would at least allow this black swan event to happen, it kind of feels like this would be it. You talk about the Red Sox, talk about the Blue Jays. The Yankees are obviously really, really good. But like, their schedule suddenly doesn't look as horrible. I mean, remember that when people were talking preseason about how the Orioles are going to be lucky to make it into double digits in wins, it was based in this idea that the East was so good in both the NL and the AL. It seems a little less so, actually, at this point. That is not to mean the Orioles are suddenly good, but it does crack a window. And then, when most of those preseason predictions did not have the expanded playoffs, there's a lot of room there for just strange things to happen. I don't actually think the Orioles have one of the top 10 records in baseball. I do not think that they are one of the best teams in baseball. But you know what? The best 10 or the best 16 teams in baseball are probably not going to be the ones that make the playoffs this year. To me, that's the fun of a year like this. In a 162 game season, obviously the Orioles in any incarnation, even 2 years from now, seems pushing it to think that they'd be able to make a playoff run. But in this season, like, to me, this is one of the fun things about baseball. This is not, again, I don't want this to be happening every year to any stretch of the imagination for a variety of reasons. However, if you were to have the fun of a 60-game season where 16 teams makes the playoffs is if you just start the season 3 or 4 games over 500 over the first 20 games, you are in good shape. And it doesn't mean the Orioles are good. It doesn't mean they're a contender, but it does mean they're in the race. And if you're going to make this playoff structure in a season like this, this is precisely the thing you're trying to make happen, right? Is that everybody feel like they're kind of in this. The Orioles are 5-3, and that's like almost a sixth of the season. That's enough to keep them, to me, in it enough to where it's at least... I feel like the piece is less about the Orioles, though I agree on Alberto and Rio Ruiz. And I actually think Santander is kind of an interesting player, even if he hasn't really done... Santander's done, but he hasn't done too much so far. But more to the point, like this is less about the Orioles and more about the format of this season and how completely wild and unpredictable it could be. I'm embracing the fun of that rather than shaking my head and saying, well, because people will do that, by the way. If like there will be a bad team that gets in the playoffs and people will shake their head gravely and say, what is happening to the sport that this team could make it? And I would say their fans had no thought that they would have any chance. And here they are in having something to root for. To me, that's kind of the fun of the season and really the fun of baseball in general.
I am going to share my favorite Orioles fact with you before we move on to something else you wrote about. John Means last year had a very good season. Was an all-star for them, second in the Rookie of the Year. You know, it kind of came out of nowhere and threw 155 good innings, as seemingly like a soft tosser, right? So this year in his first start, he comes out and all of a sudden, velocity that was not there before. He last year averaged 91.7 on his fastball. This year it's 95.2, right? So that's up 3.5 ticks. That is the largest jump of anybody who threw 104 seamers last year and 10 this year. So almost 300 guys. 3.5 ticks of velocity is a huge, enormous thing. That's the kind of thing that can change you from a good pitcher to a very good pitcher. And that made me stand up and notice, except for this fact, he got lit up. He threw 2 1/3 innings, only struck out 2, hit 2 guys, and allowed 5 earned runs. So he threw harder, but was much worse off for it. John Means, everybody.
This is the, hey, my dad put a new engine on my go-kart. Let's see how it works. And then I flam it into the wall. Like, eventually I'm going to figure out how to drive this thing. But yeah, I love it though. It's like the Charlie Morton idea, right? I always left-handed, but the idea that like, at first he's this kind of pitcher, and then all of a sudden he throws 3 or 4 mile an hour fastball in an entirely different kind.
Yeah, I like the idea of a John Means that throws harder. Like if you take last year's version and give him 95, like that's potentially a very good pitcher. I think that's cool. All right. You also wrote about some players who have surprised you. You wrote about one surprise player for every team. I have to dispute the fact that you were surprised by Aaron Judge being great, by the way, because Aaron Judge is always great. But some of the guys on your list were really interesting. You mentioned Hanser Alberto for the Orioles, right? That's who it was. But the player who surprised you the most from the National League East was Robinson Cano, actually looking kind of okay.
Yeah, and for the record, the surprise by Aaron Judge is that he was healthy for 6 straight games. So let's just to be very clear. When it comes, you know, it's funny, the Cano thing, Cano's an interesting guy because obviously with the suspension and, you know, the fact that the Mets traded for him and spent all this money, there are certain guys you generally feel, particularly in New York. I have a long time theory that it's actually harder to win for New York sports teams to win. And just the success of the Yankees has given this illusion that New York is a place of winners. But generally speaking, for the Knicks or the Rangers or so on, usually I would argue the New York part always gets in the way. And in that, like, particularly teams with like the Mets, there are certain guys, when Robinson Cano got traded to the Mets, my first thought was, oh boy, they're going to be all over him, aren't they? And they were, because, you know, generally speaking, there are certain guys, I think the ball, they're kind of behind the eight ball once they get to New York a little bit. And I think that was kind of the case with Cano. There was already the idea, he'd made a lot of money. He's an older player. It was a questionable trade, to say the least. And I think even when he started to hit a little bit, and he was a good hitter at the end of last year. And the fact that he's been a good hitter his entire career, like even when he signed with the Mariners, there was this notion that like Jay-Z doesn't know what he's doing and that's a bad contract and they're going to regret that thing. And there's always, Cano to me has always struck me as an incredibly underappreciated player. There's a good argument, again, the suspension might temper this a little bit, but I think he's been he's got a really good case for the Hall of Fame and can continue to do it. And so for him to come, and I think it would be because of that, and because the Mets seemed like a little out of it later in the year last year, I think it was kind of lost a little bit how Cano was actually a very productive player for them last year. And he's been a productive player for them now. And I think that is that trade is obviously never going to probably go down well when it comes to Kelenic for the Seattle of in Mets history. But it does seem to me that, like, I know it seems surprising because it's Cano and he's older and we have this idea this is just this dead contract. He's a good hitter, and it's perhaps should not be as surprising that he is still hitting at the age of, what is he, 37, 36, 37? And he's still hitting and still being that guy.
Never going to go down well because of how well Edwin Diaz is off to start the season as well.
Yeah, no, Cano's been the better part. Salaries aside, Cano's been the better part of that trade. And I think, you know, last year we talked about a little bit on this podcast about how a lot of it seemed to tie to Cano getting hit by a pitch and that he was like on the DL. And it seemed like once his hand was okay, he started to hit. You know, last year, we'll get, you know, going into the Statcast data for a second, he was in the 80th percentile or above in both expected batting average and hard hit rate, which is, like, you know, a really good indicator of hitting the ball well. And this year he's in again, small sample. And he like tweaked his groin last night and had to leave in like the sixth inning. So, like, who knows what's going on, but through 11 games, he's in the 90th percentile or above in hard hit rate, expected batting average and expected weighted on base. So he's like, he's hitting like vintage Cano, but it's as you said, it's kind of just overshadowed by everything.
For the Pirates, you wrote about Colin Moran, their third baseman. And I'm going to quote what you wrote because I found it entertaining. You might have known Moran before this year as BJ Surhoff's nephew, or maybe the guy whose last name is how morons spell moron. That's high quality writing. Now you know him as the NL leader in home runs with 5. I think Colin Moran, you know, best known to most people as part of the return for the disastrous Gerrit Cole trade. And I remember when that trade went down, Jeff Sullivan, who now works for the Rays, but was at Fangraphs at the time, sort of talked up Moran, you know, looked like maybe he was elevating the ball and he had some hard hit qualities, and it just hasn't really panned out. He's been fine for the last 2 years, like almost exactly an average player. And then to start this year, 5 homers, 758 slugging for a Pirates team that's not very good, but could desperately use the offense there.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's been lost because it was so long ago. He was a top prospect back in the day. Like, he was considered a top 100 prospect. It doesn't seem that way because it was like 2013. It was a very long time ago. And now he's 27, but he's almost 28, actually. He'll be 28 in October. There, I think it's been lost that there's always been kind of talent there. And you know, one of the things about him too, it feels like the Pirates, you know, Kevin Reynolds was this guy a little bit last year. They have these quietly kind of solid guys. And listen, you know, this is not necessarily the thing about Moran is he's never really been a huge power hitter, right? Like, he's always been one of those in-between guys. But it feels like one of those players that if he could just add power to his game, which is theoretically something you might do around the age of 27, that actually elevates him considerably. And yes, that is, for the record, as someone, as a Cardinals fan who's been mocked by the Cardinal fan wearing the sign that says, "Get a brain, Morans," I think about that every single time that I see Colin Moran. So that's what probably led to that joke.
I remember Moran was one of those guys. I mean, when he was drafted out of North Carolina, I think he was originally drafted by the Marlins. It was like the number five pick. He was more of like your classic, like high average, like third base. He was like the Bill Miller archetype, you know? And then in 2018, he like started to hit for power in the minors, and he did an interview with Fangraphs where he was quoted as saying, "It's tough to get too many hits on the ground. And it's always been tough to get too many extra base hits on the ground. There's a lot of focus on launch angle in the game now, for sure. Of course, Ted Williams used to talk about trying to get the ball in the air. Pulling the ball in the air is a true testament of a good hitter. If I pull the ball on the ground, it was probably a bad swing." And lo and behold, this year thus far, fly ball rate of almost 40% compared to 2016 when he was down at 13%. So clearly this has been a conscious decision by him. And for the first time, it's playing like real dividends in the early going. Well, one guy who's kind of doing the opposite of Moran, who I wanted to ask you about, who you wrote about, is Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who entered the league with so much fanfare a year ago and was, you know, fine as a rookie, considering the expectations, was definitely a bit of a disappointment. And I think a lot of people, myself included, were like, okay, this year he's going to be the guy we thought he was going to be. But, you know, 10 games in, he's been pretty disappointing again.
Yeah, you know, remember one of the things that was originally so exciting about Vlad Jr. was he had all the talent of Vladimir Guerrero, his dad, but also had a good batting eye, right? That was supposed to be the thing. That was that it was, because of course, when you heard, oh, there's a Vlad Guerrero Jr., let's see if you throw a ball 20 feet outside and he's going to swing and hit it over the right field fence. That was kind of fun of it. But actually, his minor league numbers, he actually seemed to have a pretty good batting eye and at least more apt to draw a walk than his father. That's not been the case. He's got one walk this year. He didn't have a ton of walks last year. You know, and again, you know, I think it's important to remember that in an age where Juan Soto and Ronald Acuna and Mike Trout and Bryce Harper, we have kind of got adjusted to this idea that everybody just starts a little bit earlier. Everyone just they're ready to go earlier. And I think there's some argument and a case to be made for that. Maybe Vlad Jr. isn't one of those guys, right? Like there is, like, you know, he is still only 21 years old. Obviously the raw talent is still there. But, you know, it is worth noting that, like, it's, you know, he's still a young guy. And in a lot, there's a lot of people that are going to be called up after we get through this early period who are older than him still. Like, was the great joke that that Bryce Harper is younger than Chris, or is younger than Chris Bryant, even though he came 2 years before him. Like, there are always going to be these players that feel younger, that feel older than they are. To me, Vlad is one of those guys that we're going to look up, and when he finally kind of emerges, we're like, wow, he's been around forever, and somehow he's still only 23. I feel like that's kind of the thing to remember about Vlad. I know we have the expectations. And also, I think one of the things, Matt, that you talked about was the idea that first year you got to get out of the way, and then you can start hitting. Even Trout had that like first run at the end of that year. That hasn't happened. But again, he's 21 years old. It is kind of a weird year for the Blue Jays this year. I think it's probably allotting for that as well. It's weird for everyone, but it is especially weird for them. So I don't know if they're in the most conducive environment for that. But certainly long term, I still would not be too worried about that.
Well, I was going to let you go after that. But literally, as you were talking, one of a friend of mine who works in the baseball industry texted me and said, so when is the Trent Grisham new Statcast darling article coming out? Jokingly, because I wrote about Trent Grisham last winter, and he's your Padres guy for this piece who surprised you. I love Trent Grisham, and I'm so glad to see that you do as well.
Yeah, and for the record, again, I have friends that are Brewers fans who will never forget that error. But that's definitely a chaos theory, butterfly flapping its wings one way or the other.
And the error in question was in the when he was on the Brewers last year in the wild card game, right? It was the Juan Soto hit it. Was that right?
I believe so, yes. And it basically just turned the entire game pivoted on that play, as Brewers fans have not forgotten. Remember, the Brewers were ahead of that game and looked to kind of have it, if not in hand, at least going in the right direction. And then Grisham makes that error. But yeah, you know, it's funny, of all the Padres the Padres are obviously a very exciting team right now, and there's just so much kind of fun going on with that team. To see, by the way, Tommy Pham stealing bases is something I've been desperate for Tommy Pham to have a green light since he was in Springfield, in Double-A Springfield for the Cardinals. Like, I've been waiting for him to have the green light on that. Now he's got it in like almost his mid-30s at this point. The Padres are really, really fun. But Grisham is, he feels like the kind of guy that it fits in perfect for a team like that, where he's got speed, he's got power, but there's also, other than, you know, the occasional defensive misstep that allows the Washington Nationals to win the World Series eventually, there's a steadiness to him that I think helps out well. That was an underrated of all the kind of their additions last couple of years. He's the one that really just kind of slipped in under the radar, and I think he's been terrific for them so far.
And most importantly, those brown uniforms are fantastic. I am all in on the Padres. Will Leach, thank you so much for coming and spending a few minutes with us. I'm enjoying the baseball season so far, and it sounds to me like you are, because I know that you always do. So enjoy baseball the rest of the week.
If I can't enjoy baseball, what the heck am I going to enjoy, guys, to say the least? Thanks for having me.
We will be right back with our final segment. Thank you to our good friend Will with lots of fascinating stuff on the Orioles. We're going to finish off today with first our segment on a fascinating player that you've never heard of, and then Matt and I each have a rant and a rave. Now, Matt, I think most people, let's say this, 3 days ago, no one had heard of your fascinating player, and now I'll say a few people have, but mostly not still, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, I'll admit that I didn't know who he was until Sunday, and I felt like, you know what? I should dig in a little bit deeper. So why don't I start? My fascinating player you've never heard of is Tigers reliever Tyler Alexander. Tigers reliever Tyler Alexander had one double-digit strikeout game in his entire pro career entering this week. He averaged less than a strikeout an inning as a rookie last season. But on Sunday at Comerica Park, the lefty struck out the first nine batters he faced in the first game of a seven-inning doubleheader against the Reds, tying former Tiger Doug Fister's American League record for consecutive strikeouts in a game. The nine consecutive strikeouts are major league record for, are also a major league record for reliever, Yankees reliever Ron Davis. Was that Ike Davis's dad?
I believe it is, yes.
Struck out eight consecutive Angels on May 4th, 1981. Tyler Alexander, a left-handed reliever who throws like 91. He comes on in the top of the third after Nick Castellanos' homer off Ronny Garcia and proceeds to strike out Mike Moustakas, Eugenio Suarez, Jesse Winker to end the third. Fourth inning, Nick Senzo, Josh Van Meter, Freddy Galvis. Fifth inning, strikes out Tucker Barnhart, Shogo Akiyami. He hits Castellanos to start the next inning and strikes out Mike Moustakas again. And then he picks off Travis Jankowski, placed Castellanos as a pitch runner. So a wild turn of events for Tyler Alexander. Basically throws slop, sinker at 91, mixes in a curve and a change and a slider, a little bit of a cutter, a little bit of four-seamer. In his minor league career, struck out 7.5 batters per nine innings. He was a second-round pick of the Tigers in 2015 out of TCU. He was actually originally drafted in high school by the Tigers in 2013 out of a Texas high school. So clearly, Tigers area scouts liked Tyler Alexander. And for one glorious afternoon against the Reds, he made baseball history.
I feel like there have been about 73 different pitchers named Tyler Alexander. They've all had to have been pitchers. There's never been a position player named that. If you watched the game, you know, he was obviously very good. Like, you can't fake this, but he had a pretty funny quote. He's like, "I wasn't really trying to strike anybody out until after the fifth strikeout. And then I was trying to strike people out." He basically kind of threw the same exact thing this entire outing. Everything was low and around the edges. And I will say a somewhat favorable anchor-shaped strike zone maybe benefited him here, which makes sense. You know, if you are a non-elite pitcher, and even if you are, I don't know how you get this many strikeouts in a row without a little bit of assistance. Congratulations to Tyler Alexander, because that is something he will never do again, because nobody's ever going to do that again. My name, and last week Matt gave me a little bit of friendly ribbing, assuming that every time I would do this, I would have some no-name middle reliever who has one elite pitch, and I promised that would only happen most of the time. So I'm going to make sure this one's not a reliever. Eddie Alvarez, who is a Marlins infielder. He's a 30-year-old rookie. Very interesting story here, mostly because of what has happened with him off the field. He was a pretty good high school baseball player, and then he took 6 years off of baseball. We'll get back to that in a second. He came back to baseball as a 24-year-old who signed with the White Sox as a minor league free agent in 2014, kicked around the White Sox farm system, made it to AAA, was traded to the Marlins before 2019. He's actually from South Florida, so it's a hometown reunion for him. He just got called up. Obviously, the Marlins need some reinforcements. I haven't actually seen what their roster looks like and who's available. You know, Miguel Rojas, among others, got COVID, so Alvarez might actually get some playing time. I haven't gotten to why you might care yet. The six-year gap he took was to go become Olympic-level speed skater. He won gold at the World Junior Short Track Speed Skating Championships in 2009, but didn't qualify for the 2010 Olympics. And after briefly playing community college baseball, he went back and he won a silver medal at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. He was the leadoff skater for Team USA in the 5,000-meter short track speed skating relay. Last year, in AAA, and obviously a pretty high offense environment here, he hit 323, 407, 570, which is pretty good. And now he's in the big leagues. Anytime a 30-year-old rookie comes up for the first time, that's cool. Anytime he does it for his hometown team is cooler. And anytime he's an Olympic-level speed skater, that is extremely cool. I know I cannot wait to watch Eddie Alvarez get his first plate appearance. I think that's going to be super cool.
Definitely. Right. I know the circumstances of him getting his debut are just, you know, weird and unfortunate, but it is a cool story.
Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right. Nobody would have wanted it to happen quite this way, but good for him. I think it's a really, it's a cool story, and obviously someone who loves baseball enough to keep coming back to it. So I'm excited for it to see him pitch. All right, our final segment, our purpose pitch, our closing rant. Matt has some Mets thoughts that I feel like I think I might actually disagree with this for reasons you might not expect.
I'm pleading with the baseball public to stop talking about Jacob DeGrom's one-loss record, okay? Yes, he gets a lot of no decisions, and it's sort of crazy because he's been one of the most dominant dominant pitchers in baseball the last few seasons, and I'm on record as saying that compared to most statistically inclined fans, using one-loss record as sort of a barometer doesn't bother me because I think that like sometimes it can be a good narrative tool, but the focus on DeGrom's one-loss record and he finally got a win last night totally distracts from watching one of the great pitching runs in baseball history. So it's like every time he pitches, the entire narrative is like, oh, is he going to get the win? Is he going to get the win? I mean, we all know the win stat is totally random. 5 innings, my team's winning. Sure, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We're losing track of literally watching one of the best like pitching runs in baseball history. The Mets are, and as it turns out, his record is like not reflective of the Mets. It's reflective of his ability compared to the Mets. Since he came into the league, the Mets are 493 and 490. Basically a straight 500 team. His record is 67-49, so obviously much better than the Mets record. Yes, he has a lot of no decisions, but it doesn't matter. As an aside, I'll also say that focusing on this also paints the game in a selfish light. The idea pitcher wins in general are sort of antithetical to any discussion of it being a team game. The expression, oh, they score runs for him or they don't score runs for him. No, they don't score runs for DeGrom or not for DeGrom. They score runs for the team and for the fans of that team so they can try and win games. DeGrom was never going to get to 300 wins. He was never going to get to 200 wins because he debuted when he was like 26. But he still has a chance to be a Hall of Famer and perhaps only with like 110 or 120 wins. Sandy Koufax had 169 wins, pitching in an era when every pitcher pitched complete games. The game changes. Just enjoy DeGrom.
Okay. I agree with every word you said, and yet I still disagree with you here. And here's why. I haven't heard anybody talking about his win-loss record except in the context of, like, the Mets aren't scoring for him. Like, the only time I ever hear people bring it up is just to point out how painfully unsupported he is. Like, I can't say I've honestly heard someone say he's not a good pitcher because his record is, I don't even know, 7-8 or whatever. Like, haven't we gone past that?
I think that's what I'm getting at. The idea of, like, they don't score for him. It's like, no, it's not about scoring for him. Like, yes, it's this weird thing where they often don't seem to score when he pitches, but, like, It distracts from the conversation of just like how good he is. And it's just sort of silly and pointless at this point.
All right, fair enough. That's your rant. Here's mine. When the postseason expanded this year to 8 teams in each league, I thought to myself, well, you know what? This is great because finally we're going to get to see Mike Trout in the playoffs. The Angels have not been in the playoffs since 2014 when they got swept out in the first round by the Tigers. Mike Trout, the greatest player, in my opinion, who ever lived, has not won a playoff game, has not been in one in nearly 6 years. And so I said, well, you know what? Great. 8 teams. They're not better than the Astros, although, you know, the Astros pitching staff is falling apart. So maybe they're not better than the A's and they're not better than, you know, the Rays or one of the teams in the Central for the wild card. In a regular season, they weren't going to get in this year. But this year, great. 8 teams. They're going to get in. The Angels are 3-7 to start the season. Their playoff odds, if you were to look at Fangraphs, have collapsed from, let's see, they are down 15%. They were at almost 60% before, and now they are down to about 42%. And as we talked about earlier, Otani is injured. Their pitching staff is, you know, the bullpen has been a total nightmare. I like the lineup. I get it. Adele's coming up. That's wonderful. But Simmons is hurt. Pujols is what he is at this point. They're going to miss the playoffs in an expanded playoff season. And we don't know that the expanded playoffs are here to stay. They might go back to normal next year. I don't know. If you cannot get Mike Trout to October in this situation, when are you ever going to do it? And for all the talk we have about Mike Trout, is he a star outside of baseball? Is he marketed properly? All of this, it comes down to the fact he plays on a team that never wins and never gets to the postseason. And I'm really worried it's going to happen this year. And it's not cool, Angels. It's not cool. That's my rant. That is our show for this week. That is the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. Thank you to our friend Will Leach. Thank you to Matt. I'm Mike. We will be back sometime soon. Thank you.
It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution. that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.